If you have a brain, you have bias. So let's just own it. Some biases help us by simplifying our decision-making process. Other biases hold us back by impacting who gets hired and promoted, and even who we approach to be our friends. Welcome to Breaking the Bias, a podcast where we interview impact makers who are breaking the bias when it comes to inclusion and equity, because sharing our stories is how real belonging happens.
This sort of culture, I guess, wokeness or whatever, right? Where it's like everyone's in a box and so afraid to like say that they have any biases, right? Or that there's anything that makes them uncomfortable. In order for people to explore their truth, it has to be made okay to do so.
Did you know the U.S. incarcerates Black people at a nearly 5 times higher rate than white people? This is part 2 in our Breaking the Bias series for Black History Month, where we are highlighting people and organizations who are creating alternatives to incarceration. Today, we're speaking with a special guest, Brian Stanley, court advocate for Avenues for Justice, an organization that's been around for more than 40 years and that has successfully kept thousands of African American and Hispanic youth and young adults in New York City out of the criminal justice system. I didn't know this, but in New York City, it costs about $450,000 to incarcerate a young person for a year. But to put them through the Avenues for Justice program, it costs only about $5,750. So Brian Stanley has some fascinating insights about this. In addition to serving as a court advocate, he also works with youth as a writing tutor, basketball coach, and art teacher with a focus on hip hop. Here's what he has to say about lowering incarceration rates and new paths forward. Now, on to our conversation. Can you give our listeners just a little background on how Avenues for Justice started and what it is exactly?
Yeah, absolutely. So Avenues for Justice is actually one of the oldest youth alternative to incarceration programs in the country. Avenues for Justice started at this point, I guess it would be about 49 years ago, unofficially. And it got its start. There was a brother named Robert Siegel, who was an NYU student back in the 70s, and he lived in the Lower East Side, lived off of Tompkins Square Park. And so he sort of, you know, became friendly with young people in the neighborhood, and he thought to himself, you know, these kids could use like a safe place to go and sort of hang out, maybe do some homework, chill, just be off the street. And so he kind of turned his apartment into like a safe space for teenagers. And so then while he was at NYU, he would find different ways to get meal tickets for like the NYU cafeteria. And he would distribute them to kids in the neighborhood and whatnot, you know, go out, organize basketball games, things like that. Now, at the same time that he's doing that, now, this is a really interesting story, too. This is so New York. So Robert Siegel is a Jewish brother, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there's a Black police officer named Andrew Glover. Mm-hmm. And the original name of the Avenues for Justice, ATI, is the Andrew Glover Youth Program. So Andrew Glover was a real community police officer. He textbook, there should be his picture next to community policing. He was the guy that knew all of the kids' names and their mother's names. And he was stern, right, and strict. But he also would go play basketball with the kids, too. And, you know, talk to them and ask them, you know, how you doing in school, whatnot, right? So this guy, Andrew Glover, unfortunately, he gets murdered on duty in 1975 or 76. This is as he and Robert Siegel are in the same neighborhood, sort of building this organization.
So they knew each other, so they hung out?
Yeah, they knew each other. Robert was really moved by that, and he decided he wanted to formalize what he was doing. And he went to Andrew Glover's family and said, hey, I'm thinking of starting a nonprofit. Do I have permission to name it in his honor? And so he did that. And then once he got the nonprofit, then he applied for some funding. He said, I need an assistant. So he finds a young guy who was working in the Boys and Girls Club down in the Lower East Side, young Angel Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. So this is about 76, I guess. Unfortunately, in 78, Robert Siegel passes away as well. When he passes away,
he must have been young.
He was 28 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 28 years old. And an example also, the difference, just like young people with passion, like that they can make. This guy, you know, he started doing this at 24.
Yeah.
So Angel decides to carry on the mission. And so Angel is our executive director to this day. And so he sort of continued on the mission. He got a space in the main courthouse, the Supreme Court building in Manhattan here. He was able to secure that. Was able to buy a building in the Lower East Side that was previously occupied by drug dealers, named at the Robert Siegel Center, which is the flagship Avenues for Justice youth center on what is now has been renamed Avenues for Justice Way. That's Avenue B between 6th and 7th. And so that was about a little over 40 years ago. So now, if you're between 16 and 19, then generally speaking, your cases in Manhattan will now, they will go to the youth part as opposed to you seeing a judge in the regular adult court parts.
Oh, okay. That's amazing. Do you know Marcus Bullock from Flick Shop?
I've met him. I don't know him, but
he's going to be on a LinkedIn Live this Thursday talking to us. And yeah, like at 15, he was tried as an adult. So that's a huge thing that Avenues for Justice does or did.
Yeah, that's vital. It's really vitally important. Obviously, trying 15-year-olds as adults is unfair. And again, it's hypocritical, right? You have to be 21 to get a cigarette. Mm-hmm. If you're not old enough to make the responsible choice to smoke a cigarette, if you're not old enough to vote, right, then make it make sense that you can be, you know, culpable for your actions the same level as an adult, you know, the age of 14, 15, 16 right. years old.
Yeah.
So AFJ did that. Then for years, the program was basically based on the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. And then in 2006, AFJ expanded to uptown to Harlem so that served all of Manhattan. And today, while we have those two centers, we now service all five boroughs. And we also do a little bit of work like up in Westchester County as well. So we're expanding a little bit.
Very cool. Wow. So can you talk about why you're personally so passionate? Like, how did you end up at Avenues for Justice? And why are you personally so passionate about the cause?
Well, I think my personal experiences, you know, certainly lent itself to that. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in rough neighborhoods and neighborhoods in which it's old and almost sounds tired now, to me at least. But, you know, there are a lot of friends that I had as a teenager that are dead or in jail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it had an impact on me. I've always, I think, as every kid does, I've always wanted to, like, do something about the things that bother me, you know, and sort of be a part of the solution. And I think it's the easiest way for me to keep my sanity is to be engaged in doing something. One of the things, you know, also like talking to the young people, I guess it applies to me. It's like the degree to which you do something good to make things better, to that same degree, like the world you live in will be a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So, you know, just do that. And I'll tell you though, but in AFJ in particular, because there's a lot of places that do this sort of work. But the thing about Avenues for Justice that appealed to me and why I'm here is because their approach in recognizing that we're dealing with a whole person,
mm-hmm.
right? This is more than offering services sort of in isolation, this compartmentalized thing like, oh, well, let's get you a job training. Let's get you your high school equivalency. We spend a lot of individual time with all of our clients We build relationships with their families. We advocate for them in schools. We do as much as we'll go on medical visits, appointments with them, you name it. And we have to build a real rapport, because these young people are living in a world where they don't have a lot of places to turn where they can feel genuine trust, right? And like someone really has their back and is with them.
Yeah, that was a question I had. It was from a podcast I listened to on, I think Felony Inc. It said, you try to appeal to youth by being authentic and highlighting pragmatism versus morality. And just like what you're talking about now, why is that a more effective approach?
First of all, I respect their intellect and their perception, and our kids, I'm going to be, you know, they have very strong bullshit meters, stronger than most people, because of the environments that they live in, the things that they've come up around. You have to recognize a con, right? You have to recognize a con, and sooner than now, you have to recognize it. And so, number one, they're going to pick up on me not being authentic. And it's insulting for someone to think that whatever it is that you live and is your authentic life, that they're going to come along and do some sort of like impersonation, cosplay thing or whatever, and that it's going to fly by you, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't engage in being anything other than myself for that reason. And the other, as far as the morality, and again, them being perceptive, they see that society is not moral, and it never has been, right? What you can and can't do depends on who you are and what position you're in, right? Mm-hmm. And so, for example, you know, a pharmacy, when I grew up, we called pharmacies drugstores, mm-hmm. right? It's a drugstore,
yeah.
Right? And people, the very same things that they're prescribing right now, we have an opioid crisis, right? So people, there are people who are like esteemed members of our society who can sell drugs depending on the context that you're in.
Yeah.
Very same, right? If these same kids, they can go to war, they can have a case here where they might go away for 15 to 25 for shooting someone. But if they do it, if they do that under the orders of some older dude on their block, but if they do it under the orders of someone from the recruitment office, you know, then now they're getting medals for doing the same thing. They see this, right? So I kind of leave that alone and get more to like the issue of self-worth and value. The decisions that you're making, the chances that you are taking, this is the potential cost, right? So the cost-benefit analysis, like, do you recognize your own value to the extent that you can say, this action right now, impulsive action or to get some immediate result, may cost me 5, 10, 15 years. And then what 5, 10, and 15 years also means, the compound effect of that. It's not just the time that you're missing. It's everything else that happens in that time. It's the disintegration of your family and your relationships, right? And then you coming out and you being that much further behind, right? Mm-hmm. That's an extreme example if they decide to commit a crime. But, you know, if it's, you know, whether or not you're going to go to school, mm-hmm. whatever it is, I don't really talk to them about the right thing as much.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, how do you get youth to understand their worth, to understand, to take care of themselves and make better decisions?
That's probably the most difficult part of my job. They are born into a society that has given them the message that their worth is not very high from the beginning. And I think that the most powerful messages are oftentimes are the ones that are even nonverbal. You know, even if you talk to like psychologists and psychiatrists, mental health experts and professionals, they'll talk about the profound impact on like all your pre-linguistic stuff. And then after that, you know, early childhood, right? The things you can't even remember. So, so just by virtue of like, if you're born into a neighborhood that isn't beautiful, you know, that looks like nothing here is valued, but like clearly it's good enough for you, right? Because you're here, right? And your family is here. Everyone that you know is here, right? You go into the school. It's clear that this isn't a space that people thought to invest a lot into to develop you, right? And so all around, you see in these things. And then there's obviously, you know, media images and, you know, people that look like you, their contributions being removed from history. So you have very little to contact or connect with that tells you that you have value. And so at the point when you meet a young person and they're 15, 16, 17 years old, this is 15, 16, 17 years, 24 hours a day that they've been getting this message, and now they meet Mr. Bryan in the youth center one afternoon. And so it's a process, but it's just like the marathon. We just take it one step at a time. You know, I address the young men as kings as often as I can. I address the young women as queens. I just try to really speak to them with respect. Little things. I try not to stand over them. If they're sitting down and I'm standing up and we're talking, I sit down, you know, or I'll crouch down so that I'm lower than them. Also, all sorts of things. It's a case by case.
So you talked about the services that AFJ offers as the first alternative to incarceration for youth. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, so the U.S. incarcerates more people than any country in the world, right? In part because other countries don't use prison as a one-size-fits-all solution for crime. And what ways do you think the issue of mass incarceration is, it costs our communities and our workplaces and society at large? Like, can you kind of unpack that for us? Like,
yeah,
this is huge. This is important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we lose talent. You know, we lose talent, we lose contributors to our society, and they are warehoused somewhere, basically wasting away. So that's the first thing, right? Is we lose this potential talent. We don't know who or what any given person that is incarcerated, what they might be, can become, right? I'm sure if we go into the histories of a lot of people that have done great things, maybe when they were young, something happened or they had a stretch of a year or two where it's like, wow, this person is really, you know, this kid is out of control. Because it's like, the kid is out of control. Obviously, it's not just kids. They're older, you know, adults as well. But right. So I think there's that. And then also, it has a compounding effect, because then as opposed to these people contributing to the greater society, whether it's materially, wealth, ideas, ingenuity. Also now we're burdened with warehousing them and the cost of that. So it's a complete loss, really. Psychologically, it's a win to a lot of people, but tangibly, it's a loss.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about that psychologically? It's a win to a lot of people. Like, why? Why is that? And why is this so problematic?
I mean, I think psychologically, a lot of people want to see other people that they think of as bad be punished. And so they're satisfied. They get a satisfaction out of feeling like people are not escaping punishment, not getting away with something. But it's interesting, though, because it's like particular people. Often, like what you could argue is like people that are in some of the weaker positions in society. So that's that sort of psychological win. It allows them to feel better than someone also. But then, like I said, tangibly, we lose all the, like literally it costs us money.
Yeah, I read on AFJ's website that it costs $450,000 to incarcerate someone in New York City for 1 year. And the cost for the AFJ program, I think, was $5,720. That's a huge discrepancy. Like, Can you help unpack if there's an alternative solution that saves everybody money and that benefits people on the ground, why we might not be using this across the country and more widely?
It's a great question. I mean, that disparity is so vast. It's beyond huge, might not even be enough of an adjective to describe that. It's insane. I think it goes back to culture. When you talk about culture, you're talking about values. What you value, you invest in, right? And so people can say whatever they want, but you'll know their values by what they invest in. And so that figure is just a reflection of how invested we as a society are, and many individuals in our society are, in the punishment, incarceration of certain people versus doing something, them getting some sort of like free help, you know, and people feel like I don't want to fund your help, the help you're going to receive in any way. And so it's like, I'm willing to pay 100 times that to punish you, because that's what you're invested in.
And I mean, is the prison system a business? Are we making money off of this? I've read some things about that. I'm just curious, like, if you can help.
Yeah, there's money made. I mean, the thing though with that is there's money made in everything in the United States. There's literally not a thing going on where there isn't money made. There's a lot more money lost than the money that's made. Yes, people get contracts for building prisons and they employ correction officers, and obviously the system as a whole, right? There's attorneys, there's police officers, there's a, you know, expansive sort of like system, all these like appendages to the system where, there's money going around, but you think about, say, 2 million people incarcerated, right? Mm-hmm. So 2 million. Now, a billion is 1,000 million. Right? That's a billion, right? 1,000 million. So I say that to say, okay, so if you have 2 million people that, let's say, they earn a paltry living of $1,000 a month.
Right.
That's $2 billion a month that the economy loses. And that's not even a realistic figure, right? Like they would, on average, would make more money than right? Because minimum wage would put you higher than that, right? Mm-hmm. But so at something that's below minimum wage, just these people being in the workforce, that would put...
fuels the economy. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And then those are people that are in the tax base and all of that. So the money that the prisons make or generate for whoever, it doesn't compare at all to what we're losing.
So what is your hope? Like, what do you think needs to happen next? Because obviously... the system is broken. Like, and this is a big question, but what are some of the steps that you think needs to happen next to kind of fix this and provide alternatives to incarceration?
Excellent. Excellent question. I think that we need people to do a real honest self-assessment. Each one of us do an honest self-assessment about what do we genuinely think about these issues and how much do we care? One of the issues, this is Black History Month now, right? And this all ties in. Black people, for example, and this applies to brown people as well, Black people in this country, our biggest problem historically, and one that impacts us to this day, bigger than slavery, is that we've just been lied to. The truth has been kept from us for hundreds of years. You know, people were always hiding their true thoughts and intentions behind lie after lie after lie. And so if you're given lies, you don't have the ability to assess what is the correct course of action for you, right? You don't have an ability to see the landscape for what it is, right? So there's people that are saying that they care, but they don't, right? There were people that were taught that they had no history, made no contributions, right? And so that's not true. That's a profound profound lot. Like I said, I'm from here in New York City, and virtually no one in New York City knows that probably one of the most iconic things about New York City, which is the subway system, a black man designed that system. You know, Granville T. Woods invented the third rail electric train technology. Before that, it was steam trains, right? And you can't run steam trains and coal powered trains underground. Everyone would die.
Right.
And so this man, he invented this entire system. And you can grow up here as a black kid and go to public schools. The public schools are 80% children of color. And they'll go there and never learn that. But so I say all that to say, to circle back around. So if people are willing to be honest about where they stand and be willing to communicate that to other people, right? And maybe not have the fear of being seen as a bad person. If they realize this actually makes you a better person. Like, it's whatever you think or feel, it's okay because it's human. But if you can come clean to other human beings, if you're at work and you're able to have open conversations and say, hey, you know, I'm uncomfortable around this brown woman, right? Or, you know, I'm uncomfortable around this guy with this wrap on his head that I don't really understand, right? And if you're allowed to say that, as opposed to this thing that's going on now, this sort of culture, I guess, wokeness or whatever, right? People, where it's like everyone's in a box and so afraid to like say that they have any biases, right? Or that there's anything that makes them uncomfortable. That has to, in order for people to explore them, their truth, it has to be made okay to do so. And we just got to start with the truth. This whole society, it's the way it is because it was built on lies. We got to just get to the truth.
Yeah, because I mean, fear breeds silence, right? It keeps people from speaking up and being honest. And I know, like we always say, like everybody has bias. It's part of being human. It's not something to feel bad about. But I mean, some biases even help us in our decision making, but there are biases that really hinder who we promote, who we, you know, who we approach to be our friend. And if we can become aware of those, I guess it starts with like curiosity and honesty, right? Like not pretending it's not there.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Don't pretend for yourself or for other people, because also it's like, maybe there's some other courses of action that people need to take and maybe those are okay. Right. So we've got racism, we've got sexism, we've got all these different things going on. Right. And it's like, maybe women need to start their own corporations and businesses and institute like their own culture, as opposed to trying to make something that was never designed for you to be inclusive of you. Right. Like, which isn't to say that you shouldn't be able to work there, but I'm saying, but if people will admit where they're coming from, then maybe you can pivot from that. And then it's like, even if well-meaning people can even support that, like, hey, listen, I don't know how to change the culture of what I've built, that I can't even wrap my mind around that. But it's like, I can help you start something and you show me, you lead, you know, because also it has to change. Like the same people can't be in charge of a totally different mission.
Exactly. And I think people like to hold on to power. They believe there's no incentive to change if that means giving up some of their power. But I think that's the only way that the systems will change, because you're exactly right. The same people in power can't create the change that needs to happen. That has to come, I think, from people who have traditionally been oppressed to say, this is what needs to happen. This is what we need. And this is what needs to change.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Where can people go to find out more about Avenues for Justice and help out?
Avenues for Justice, it's really easy. Avenuesforjustice.org. Also, very simple. Like, people want something simple and actionable, give money to the program. And programs like it. It allows us to hire more people, serve more youth, have them access like more resources, whether it's more programs, trainings, able to pay for, whether it's, you know, any sort of service that they need, give them access to technology. So, yeah, that's an easy thing.
So go to the website and they can find out where to donate.
Yeah, they can definitely support. Find out. Yeah, the website is very easy to navigate. They can see a lot of information about what we have going on. Now they will see how to donate. There's also a page for people that are interested in volunteering. If they have some way that they want to volunteer, we encourage companies and organizations to consider our Higher Up program, which is a mentorship to internship to full-time employment program. So, yeah, there are a variety of ways that are all accessible through that portal.
Yeah, Higher Up, and there's the Second Chances. Is that the job readiness?
The Second Chance Award?
I read something about a Second Chances program, so I just want to make sure I didn't miss any of the highlights. Well,
that's kind of sort of what we see ourselves primarily is as a second chance program. So I think that's what you were talking about.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's giving them a second chance, giving youth the second chance. That sort of motto, services, not sales. You know, when a young person enters into the criminal court system, we kind of, for us, that's almost like a notification on the iPhone. It's like, oh, that's a young person in need, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's hard to know, like walking the street, you don't know who needs what, but this is a pretty good indicator. And so we kind of want to shift the sort of thinking around that in the city and then hopefully in the greater society towards that, to seeing this not as like criminality or deviance, but like, this is an indicator. This is someone we need to get to. What do we need to get to them?
Well, the work that you do is amazing. Thank you so much for, you know, taking the time and sharing all your knowledge with us and, you know, our listeners. I just think it's so important to make people aware of solutions, right? Of the problem, but also that there are solutions and there are people on the ground who are working to change the culture and the system, and that we can all do something to help too. So I'm excited to tell people about you, tell about the website and Avenues for Justice and the volunteering and the donating portion. Is there anything else that you think is really important to add that I didn't ask you?
I would just go back to, you know, sort of touching on the name of this podcast, right? Breaking the Bias. I just really encourage people to seriously, let's investigate our own biases. Let's just investigate them and confront them. That's the first part of the work that is really so huge. You know what I mean? And then figure out what we want to do from there. Because the next step is then to figure out, where does our bias fit into the world that we want to be in, right? Because it's like, you may have this bias. It is, there's Black folk, for example, brown folk, who may feel like they have reasons to not like white folk, right? There's a reason that they can feel that way. Okay, that's cool. So they got to acknowledge that first. The next question that they have to ask themselves is the same thing. It's like, okay, so now this bias as it stands, what does that mean for the world that you're trying to live in? What world are you trying to live in, right? And then if the answer to that question, say, is maybe a more peaceful, cooperative world, then when you get that part, that's compelling enough to shift the bias. You know what I mean? It's just like, wait, okay, so this is untenable. And so just all of us, we need to do that. We need to figure out what it is that we really want, where are we at now, and where can we get to that'll be a part of the solution.
I love that. Yeah. So I think what you're saying, it's an inside job. Like, you have to acknowledge your bias, how it's showing up, how it's impacting how you show up. And then wherever, I mean, we all have different passions. So like, what piece of that can you take out from whatever you've learned and change within the world? And if we all find those pieces, then we're all working separately, but together on a bigger change, right? And that's like, that's our job here, I feel like, is to figure that out. So thank you for the inspiration and all of the advice. Really appreciate it, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity and your interest and you're doing great work.
You can learn more about our guests and get show notes at consciouslyunbiased.com/listen. And we want to hear from you. Please subscribe and rate Breaking the Bias on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcasts. And drop us a note to let us know if there is a topic you really want to hear about or a guest you want to have on the show. Thanks for listening to Breaking the Bias.